den Richtlinien so vorgenommen worden sind, wie wir das für richtig halten. Das heißt...
Hey, Billy, why do you look so down?
Aw, Dad, I got a computer, a PlayStation, and a barn full of iguanas, and I'm still bored.
Gee, Billy, when I was your age, I would read lots of stories in pulp magazines. Oh, with stories of weird adventure and fantasy, horror, satire, and lots of action.
Wow, that sounds great, Dad.
Yeah, I sure wish there was something like that right now. There is, Daddy-O!
Who are you?
I'm Dr. Mary Von Rocksprocket, host of the Twisted Pulp Radio Hour. And now there's...
Yeah?
Twisted Pulp Magazine!
What's that, Doctor?
Why, it is a return to greatness! Available on all your digital devices! That is what it is! Look!
This looks awesome!
Exciting and, dare I say it, very unwholesome. You definitely have that right, my good man. Ha ha!
Thanks, Dr. Mary.
My pleasure, Billy. And just between you and me, I am not sure that this man is really your father. Bye.
Dad?
Just read your Twisted Pulp magazine, Billy. Twisted Pulp magazine! Available in dark alleyways behind meth labs everywhere. Or at Amazon.com or archaicmedia.info. That is archaicmedia.info. Ha 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 ha!
Knackles by Donald Westlake. Read by Wesley Critchfield. Did God create man, or does man create gods? I don't know. If it hadn't been for my rotten brother-in-law, the question would never come up. My late brother-in-law. Knackles. Nose. It all depends, you see. Like the chicken and the egg. Which came first? Did God exist before man thought of him, or didn't he? If not, man creates his gods, and then it follows that man must create the devils, too. Nearly every god, you know, has his own corresponding evil. Good and evil. The polytheistic ancients, prolific in the creation of gods and goddesses, always worked up enough evil ones to cancel out the good, but not quite. The Greeks, those incredible supermen, combined good and evil in each of their gods. In Zoroaster and Ura and Mazda, being good is ranged forever against the evil one, Ahriman. We ourselves know God and Satan. But of course, it's entirely possible I have nothing to worry about. It all depends on whether Santa Claus is or isn't a god. He certainly seems like a god. Consider that he's omniscient. He knows every action of every child, for good or evil. At least on Christmas Eve, he's omnipresent, everywhere at once. He administers justice and tempers it with mercy. He's superhuman, or at least non-human, though conceived as having a human shape. He's aided by a corps of assistants who do not have completely human shapes. He rewards good and he punishes evil. And, most important, he is believed in utterly by several million people, most of them under the age of 10. Is there any other qualification for godhood that Santa does not possess? Even the non-believers give him lip service. He's surely taken over Christmas. His effigy is everywhere. But where are the manger and the Christ child? Retired rather forlornly to the nave. Santa's power is growing, too. Slowly but surely, he's usurping Hanukkah as well. Santa Claus is a god. He's no less a god than Ahura Mazda, or Odin, or Zeus. Think of that white beard and that chariot being pulled through the snow by a breed of animal which doesn't ordinarily fly. The prayers, requests for gifts, which are usually mailed to him, and which so baffle the post office, the specially garbed priest, and every department store. And don't the gods reflect their creator society? The Greeks had a huntress goddess, and gods of agriculture and war and love. What else would we have but a god of giving, of merchandising, and of consumption? Secondary gods of earlier times have been stout, but surely Santa Claus is the first fat primary god. And wherever there's a god, mustn't there sooner or later be a devil? Which brings me back to my brother-in-law, who's to blame for whatever happens now. My brother-in-law, Frank, is, or was, a very mean and nasty man. Why I ever let him marry my sister, I will never know. Why Susie wanted to marry him is an even greater mystery. I could just shrug and say that love is blind, I suppose, but that wouldn't explain how she fell in love with him in the first place. Frank was, I just don't know what tense to use. The present, hopefully. Frank is a very handsome man in his way. Big and brawny and full of vitality. A football player, hero in college, and a defensive linebacker for 3 years in pro ball, till he did some sort of irreparable damage to his left knee, which gave him a limp and forced him to find some other way of making a living. Ex-football players tend to become insurance salesmen. I don't know why. Frank followed the form, and he became an insurance salesman. Because Susie was then a secretary for the same company, they soon became acquainted. Susie was dazzled by the ex-hero, so big and handsome. She's never been the type to dazzle easy, but we can never fully know what goes on inside the mind of another human being. For whatever reason, she decided that she was in love with him. So they were married. And 5 weeks later, he gave her first black eye. And the last. Though it might not have been, since Susie tried to keep me from finding out. I was to go over for dinner that night, but at 11 in the morning she called the auto showroom where I work to tell me that she had a headache and we had to postpone dinner. But she sounded so upset I knew immediately something was wrong. So I took a demonstration car over, and when she opened the front door, there was the Shiner. I got the story out of her slowly, in fits and starts. Frank, it seemed, had a terrible temper. She wanted to excuse him because he was forced to be an insurance salesman when he really wanted to be out there on the gridiron again. But I want to be the president, and I am an automobile salesman, and I don't go around giving women black eyes. So I decided it was up to me to let Frank know that he wasn't to vent his pique on my sister anymore. Unfortunately, I'm 5'7" tall and weigh 140 pounds, with the Sunday Times under my arm. Were I to just give Frank a piece of my mind, he'd surely give me a black eye to go along with my sister's. Therefore, that afternoon, I bought a regulation baseball bat, and I carried it with me when I went to Frank's that night. He opened the door himself and snarled, "What do you want?" In answer, I poked him with the end of the bat, just above the belt, to knock the wind out of him. Then, having unethically gained the upper hand, I clouted him 5 or 6 times more. Then I stood over him to say, "The next time you hit my sister, I won't let you off so easy." After which, I took Susie home to my place for dinner. After which, I was Frank's best friend. People like that are so impossible to understand. Until the baseball bat episode, Frank had nothing for me but undisguised contempt. Once I'd knocked the stuffing out of him, he was my comrade for life, and I'm sure he was sincere. He would have given me the shirt off of his back if I'd wanted it, which I didn't. Also, by the way, he never hit Susie again. He still had a bad temper, but he took it out on the furniture or the windows or by punching dents in the walls or going downtown to start a brawl in a bar. I offered to train him out of maltreating the house and furniture as I had trained him out of maltreating his wife, but Susie said no, that Frank had to let off steam, and it would be worse if he was forced to bottle it all up inside of him. So the baseball bat remained in retirement. Then came the children, three of them, in as many years. Frank Jr. came first, then Linda Joyce, and finally Stuart. Susie had held a forlorn hope that fatherhood would settle Frank to some extent, but quite the reverse was true. Shrieking babies, smelly diapers, disrupted sleep, and distracted wives are trials and tribulations to any man, but to Frank they were, like everything else in his life, the last straw. He became, in a word, worse. Susie restrained him, I don't know how often, from doing severe damage to a squalling infant. And as the children grew toward the age of reason, Frank's expressed attitude toward them was that their best move would be to find a way to become invisible. And the children, of course, didn't like him very much. But who did? Last Christmas is when it started. Junior was 6 then, and Linda Joyce was 5, and Stuart was 4. Also, they were all old enough to have heard of Santa Claus, and still young enough to believe in him. Long about October, when the Christmas season was beginning, Frank began to use Santa Claus's displeasure as a weapon to keep the kids in line, his phrase for keeping them terrified and mute and immobile. Many parents, of course, try to enforce obedience in the same way. If you're bad, Santa Claus won't bring you any presents. Which, all things considered, is a negative and passive sort of punishment, wishy-washy in comparison with the fire and brimstone and such. In the old days, Santa Claus would treat children a bit more scornfully, leaving them a lump of coal in their stockings in lieu of presents. But I suppose the Depression helped change that. There are times and situations where a lump of coal is nothing to sneer at. In any case, the absence of presents was too weak of a punishment for Frank's purposes, so last Christmas he invented Knackles. Who is Knackles? Knackles is to Santa Claus what Satan is to God, what Ahriman is to Ahura Mazda, what the North Wind is to the South Wind. Knackles is the new evil. I think Frank really enjoyed creating Knackles. He gave so much thought to the details of him. According to Frank, and as I remember it, this is Knackles.
Very, very tall and very, very thin. Dressed all in black. With a gaunt, gray face and deep, black eyes. He travels through an intricate series of tunnels in the earth, in a black chariot on rails, pulled by an octet of dead white goats. And what does Knackles do? Knackles lives on the flesh of little boys and little girls.
This is what Frank was telling the children, can you believe it?
Knackles roams back and forth under the earth, in his dark tunnels, darker than any subway tunnel. Pulled by 8 dead white goats, he searches for little boys and little girls to stuff into his big black sack and carry them away to eat. But what Santa Claus won't let him have is the good boys and girls. Santa Claus is stronger than Knackles, and he keeps a protective shield around little children, so Knackles can't get at them. But when little children are bad, it hurts Santa Claus, and weakens the shield Santa Claus has placed around them. And if they keep on being bad, pretty soon there's no shield left at all. And on Christmas Eve, instead of Santa Claus coming down out of the sky with his bag of presents, Knackles comes up out of the ground with his bag of emptiness and stuffs bad children in and whisks them away in his dark tunnels and the 8 dead white goats.
Frank was proud of his invention. Actually proud of it. He'd not only used Knackles to threaten his children every time they had the temerity to come within range of his vision, he also spread the story around to others. He told me, his neighbors, and the people in bars. He told people he went to see in his job as an insurance salesman. I don't know how many people he told about Knackles. Though, I would guess it was well over 100. And there's more than one Frank in this world. He told me from time to time a client or a neighbor or a bar crony would hear the story of Knackles and then say,
"By God, that's great! That's what I've been needing to keep my brats in line!"
Thus, Knackles was promulgated. And would any of the unfortunate children thus introduced to Knackles believe in this evil being any less than they believe in Santa Claus? Of course not. All this happened, as I say, last Christmas time. Frank invented Knackles, used him to further intimidate his already intimidated children, and spread the story of him to everyone he met. On Christmas Day last year, I'm sure there was more than one child in this town who was relieved and even somewhat surprised to awaken, as usual, in his own trundle bed to find that the presents downstairs were under the tree, proving that Knackles had been kept away for yet another year. Knackles lay dormant, so far as Frank was concerned, from December 25th of the year until this October. Then, with the sights and sounds of Christmas around again in the land, back came Knackles, as fresh and vicious as ever.
"Don't expect me to stop him,"
Frank would shout.
"When he comes up out of the ground the night before Christmas to carry you away in his bag, don't expect any help from me."
It was worse this year than last. Frank wasn't doing as well financially as he had expected in early November. Susie discovered she was pregnant again, and what with one thing and another, Frank was headed for another real peak of ill temper. He screamed at the children constantly, and the name of Knackles was never far from his tongue. Susie did what she could to counter Frank's bad influence, but he wouldn't let her do much. All through November and December, he was home more and more of the time. And because Christmas season is the wrong time to sell insurance anyway, and also because he was hating his job more and more every day, and thus giving it less of his time, the more he hated the job, the worse his temper became. The more he drank, and the worse his limp got. And the louder were his shouts, and the more violent his references to Knackles. It just built and built and built, and it reached a crescendo on Christmas Eve, when some small, unimagined infraction of one of the children, Stuart, I think it was, resulted in Frank's pulling all the Christmas presents out of the closets and stowing them all in the car to be taken back to the stores, because this Christmas, for sure, it wouldn't be Santa Claus who would be arriving at the house. It would be Knackles. By the time Susie got the children to bed, everyone in the house was a nervous wreck. The children were too frightened to sleep, and Susie was too unnerved herself to be much help in soothing them. Frank, who had taken to drinking at home lately, had locked himself in the bedroom with a bottle. It was nearly 11 o'clock before Susie got the children quieted down and went out to the car and brought all the presents back in and arranged them under the tree. Then, not wanting to see or hear her husband any more that night, he was like a big spoiled child throwing a tantrum, she herself went to sleep on the living room sofa. Frank Jr. awoke her the next morning crying,
"Look, Mama, Knackles didn't come. He didn't come."
And he pointed at the presents that she'd placed under the tree. The other two children came down shortly after, and Susie and the youngsters sat on the floor and opened presents, enjoying themselves as much as possible, but still with restraint. There were none of the usual squeals of childish pleasure. No one wanted Daddy to come storming down the stairs in one of his rages, so the children contented themselves with ear-to-ear smiles and whispered exclamations. And after a while, Susie made breakfast, and the day carried on pleasantly, as could be expected under the circumstances. It was a little after 12 that Susie began to worry about Frank's non-appearance. She braved herself to go up and knock on the locked door and call his name, but she got no answer. Not even the expected snarl. So just around 1 o'clock, she called me, and I hurried over. I rapped smartly on the bedroom door, and got no answer. And finally, I threatened to break down the door if Frank didn't open up. When I still got no answer, break down the door, I did. Frank, of course, was gone. The police say he ran away, deserted his family primarily because of Susie's fourth pregnancy. They say he went out of a window and dropped into the backyard so Susie wouldn't see him and try to stop him. And they say he didn't take the car because he was afraid Susie would hear him starting the engine. That sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Yet I can't believe Frank would just walk out on Susie without a lot of shouting first. Nor that he would leave his car, which he was fonder of than his wife and children. But what's the alternative? There's only one I can think of. Knackles. I would rather not believe that. I would rather not believe that Frank, in inventing Knackles and spreading word of him, made him real. I would rather not believe that Knackles actually did visit my sister's house on Christmas Eve. But did he? If so, he couldn't have carried off any of the children, for a more subdued and better-behaved trio of youngsters you'd never find anywhere. But Knackles, being brand new and never having had a meal before, would need somebody. Somebody for whom he was real. Somebody not protected by the shield of Santa Claus. And, as I say, Frank was drinking that night. Alcohol makes the brain believe in the existence of all sorts of things. Also, Frank was a spoiled child if ever there was one. There's no question that Frank Jr. or Linda, Joyce, or Stuart believes in Knackles. Frank spread the gospel of Knackles to others, some of whom spread it to their own children, some of whom will spread the new evil to other parents. And Oz is a mobile society, with families constantly being transferred by Daddy's company from one end of the country to the other. How long can it be before Knackles' power is not only in one city, but all across the nation? I don't know if Knackles exists or will exist. All I know for sure is that there's suddenly a new level of meaning to the lyric of that old popular Christmas song. You know the one I mean. You'd better watch out.